I have a couple announcements to start with. Don't use 16:9 resolution on the PowerPoints. I did not know you had to do that, so thank you, Adam, for that. I didn't mention this Sunday, and I should have, but my stepbrother passed away Saturday morning early with a heart attack, and his birthday would have been on April the 11th, and he would have been 64, so he was certainly not, old. And the funeral will be tomorrow, and I decided it probably wouldn't be best for me to try to probably make it, appreciate y'all's concern and prayers about that. So shall we begin with a word of prayer tonight? Our Holy God, we are so grateful we can come together with your people. We're grateful for your word. We're grateful that it has the power to create and transform, that even as it did at the beginning in the creation, and so it has even more so in recreating us in your image. And so we pray that as you created light in the beginning, that light would be reflected in our life, that others may see the light of the gospel of Christ, and to long for that light, to turn away from the darkness that so besets this world. We are sorry, Father, for the many ways that we have contributed to the darkness. But we are grateful that day by day the darkness is passing away and the true light is dawning more each day. And we're grateful for occasions such as this. We can study your word together to draw strength from it, to better understand who you are, and thereby who we should be as well. We are mindful of the needs of so many who struggle with various difficulties of finances and health and just the day-to-day difficulties of this life we live. But most of all, we are mindful of the spiritual struggles that we each face and pray that you would strengthen us, that we would cast our concerns and worries upon you, and that we might be of some help to one another. Most of all, we want to be more like Jesus, and it's through him and your spirit we pray, and amen. All right, so we are in 2 Chronicles chapter 32, and so we have noted that as we've gone through 1 and 2 Chronicles, a lot of these kings just get a very short treatment, and then we move on. The writer, again, is focusing almost solely upon the line of David and the kings of the southern kingdom of Judah after it splits. And now, of course, that during the time of Hezekiah's father, Ahaz, the Assyrians have wiped out the northern kingdom of Israel. We're just left with a single kingdom once again. And lo and behold, what the writer does is pause now for a good while, because chapters 29, 30, 31, and 32 are concerned with Hezekiah. And so that just says something about the importance of him as a role model, as a type of the Davidic king, ultimately the Messiah, Christ. And we're trying to read through these stories with a view toward how the original readers, who apparently lived quite a bit into the period after the exile was over, so their concern isn't how to live in Babylon and why are we here and what are we supposed to do in this foreign land, but it's really, well, here we are back in the promised land, but we have no king. We're still under foreign oppression and government, and we're just a very tiny group of people, and what are we to make of all this, right? So you will notice that in chapters 29, 30, and 31, the focus has been on the faithfulness of Hezekiah. The statement that was made in verse 2 of chapter 29, he did right in the sight of Yahweh according to all that his father David had done. And then proceeds to tell us about all these reforms of the temple because his father had desecrated the temple both in the outer courtyard and inside. And once they get that all cleaned up, they want to observe the Passover because it's the second month, and they've missed the proper time to observe Passover. And they're trying to reunite with any of the faithful from the northern kingdom of Israel, or the remnants of what is left of those people up there. And some did come down and join them. And so there's great joy and this kind of restored worship and all of that. And even after all of that worship and joy, in the first verse of chapter 31, we notice that when the people go back home, they're all encouraged and strengthened to tear down all these high places and altars and things like that. And the rest of chapter 31 is concerned with maintaining the temple, making provision for the temple, and so on. And so, as we've said, throughout there's been this emphasis upon the line of David and the temple. And you see those elements coming together here again with Hezekiah. And so once again, we get this kind of conclusion statement at the end of chapter 31, verses 20 and 21. Thus Hezekiah did throughout all Judah. He did what was good, right, and true before Yahweh his God. Every work which he began in the service of the house of God in law and in commandment, seeking his God, he did with all his heart and prospered. And so, sounds great. And if that were all the story of Hezekiah, well, that'd be wonderful. But there's one more chapter to tell, and it's really something of an addendum, I guess we might call it. And you notice by comparison, when the writer of Samuel Kings tells the story of Hezekiah, he spends the lion's share talking about this invasion of Sennacherib in 2 Kings chapters 18 and 19. That's also the part that gets reproduced in the book of Isaiah, chapters 36 and 37. We also know a good bit about this from the records of Sennacherib himself, that he subjugated 46 fortified cities in Judah and even cooped up, Hezekiah in Jerusalem like a bird in a cage. And that all happens in 701 B.C. Kings tells us it was in the 14th year of Hezekiah's rule. And so if we count down from 715, that gets us to 701. So the way the chronicler is going to approach this is he's much more interested in Hezekiah's faithful attention to the temple and the reforms that he is making. And so it's almost counterintuitive, because we just read these verses at the end of chapter 31. Hezekiah did what was good and right and true, and he's faithful, and he did everything according to the law. And therefore, after these acts of faithfulness, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came and invaded Judah and besieged the fortified cities and thought to break into them for himself. Especially if you're a health and wealth gospel kind of person, last thing you expect is, oh, we've been faithful, what's our reward? Well, you're going to get invaded. Things are going to go really badly for a while. There's a lesson here, I think. It kind of reminds me of Asa. You remember when Asa was a young man? He was king, and he's one of the faithful, righteous kings. He was instigator of the first real major reform movement there was. And he was attacked by this Zerah and his million, man march on Judah. And Asa trusted the Lord, and the Lord delivered them from that. And it's a similar kind of thing. Asa's faithful. This invasion wasn't the result of some judgment of God. He's displeased and using it as an instrument to punish the people. And then Asa's son, Jehoshaphat, continues these reforms. And in chapter 20, he's invaded by this massive army. And he doesn't know what to do except to go to the temple and lead in prayer and humble themselves to the Lord and seek his help. And lo and behold, he delivers them as well. And then you contrast that with occasions where some kings like Joash and Ahaz, Hezekiah's father, they were faithless and they get invaded by kind of tiny armies. The Arameans were just this little small army that show up, and much bigger army of Judah being delivered over into their hands. And that clearly was a punishment by God and a response to their unfaithfulness. Well, are we to conclude that, a tiny army comes and defeats them? Well, these mega armies must be even, more punishment or something. Well, of course, the lesson that we're going to be taught here is that, sometimes God allows righteous people to be tested. His promise isn't, I'll never, let you be burned by the fire or pass through the fire. He will ultimately deliver you from the fire. It may be delivering you through death. It may be delivering you like he does Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But, the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would be quite different if, thus in their faithfulness, well, nothing bad ever happened to them. They never got thrown in a fiery furnace. Because we'd be left saying, well, it's good to be faithful, but how do you know? And here's a story God says, well, I will have them put in the fire. And it wasn't like God told them ahead of time, hey, guys, tell you what, wouldn't it be really neat if I put you in a fire and delivered you from it? Think of the impression this people will be speaking your unspeakable names, for millennia. Sure, yeah, we'll do that. And they're just strutting around in the fire, whistling, hey, no problem. God's going to show up any moment and deliver us. It's all part of the plan. But they did have faith that God would deliver them. Now, again, it might not be in the way they would like, but he would deliver them. And this is the same thing. God's passing the nation through fire. He's testing whether their faithfulness is genuine ultimately. And so here with Hezekiah, even in spite of this faithfulness that he has had, he's still going to be invaded. Now, I think as we put all the pieces together, it may in fact turn out that Hezekiah's faithfulness is not as intact or robust as it might otherwise have been. Because Isaiah, in the book of Isaiah, has quite a bit to say about the nation Judah and its leadership during this time period. The account that's in Kings would give us to understand that, in some ways, Hezekiah was not that much different than his father, thinking, well, I'll get some tribute together and buy off the Assyrians, that he rebelled against the Assyrians to begin with. And that would be a kind of question, should he have done that? He kind of inherited that condition from his father, because his father had probably didn't pretty much have a choice to make himself vassal to the Assyrians after he had called for their help and they came and kind of imposed themselves upon Judah. But that being whatever it is, what we enter into here then is this auxiliary story that makes the point that God does respond to the faithfulness of people. And you get kind of two stories together in that, the threat by the Assyrians, and God does deliver the nation from Sennacherib, and then Hezekiah's own personal sickness and threat to his life from that, and God delivers him from that as well. We've suggested that the actual chronological order here, at least it seems to me, now this isn't something universally accepted by everybody, but it seems that Hezekiah's sickness and the ambassadors from the Babylonians happened prior to the invasion by Assyria. As a matter of fact, if you look at the account in 2 Kings, part of what God says in response to healing Hezekiah of his sickness is, I will deliver you from the hand of the Assyrians. And that seems most likely to me to be a reference to the fact that that's not happened yet, and perhaps that was sent by God as something of a chastisement of the pride of Hezekiah that he got into because he recovered from his sickness and so on. So anyway, at whatever time it happened, he did rebel against his Assyrian overlord, quit paying his tribute. As we noted last time, it's going to take 4 years for Sennacherib to, you know, make his way around to Judah to subjugate them back into line. So I'm going to go ahead and work through my slides here. So these are the series of Assyrian emperors, and we're down to this period of Sennacherib at the bottom. And we noted Sargon II died in 705, and widespread across the Assyrian Empire, people are revolting. This is their chance. The next guy can't nearly be as powerful or as proficient a military leader or governor, so this is our chance. Take our chances with some newbie who's inexperienced, only to find out Sennacherib was more than capable. And so he invades Judah in 701. Now, he's going to die in 681, so it's going to be 20 years after this event we're talking about here. And he's going to be assassinated by his own kids. So I hesitate to bring that up and give any ideas to any of my children that may be present. But anyway, that's kind of a terrible thing to happen, obviously. A kind of a mark of the judgment that, I mean, what a despicable person this must be, that your own children will kill you in a temple. And so that's seen as a divine judgment against him, appropriately so. And so we saw this slide last time in the 4x3 format, so we didn't have to mess with the projector. But it summarizes this about Hezekiah, that he was righteous but imperfect, has this third major reform movement, and has this sickness that is so bad he's going to die from it, but he prays to the Lord, and the Lord extends his life by 15 years, and the Babylonians show up to say, well, we heard you were sick, and you recovered, and boy, there was this miraculous thing that happened with the sun. What's up with that, you know? But I think it's pretty obvious the Babylonians were also interested in getting Hezekiah on board with some kind of anti-Assyrian alliance to resist the power of the Assyrians. And also there are hints that Judah, and this always seems to be the case, whoever the king was, there was probably always a significant faction among his counselors that said, Egypt is where the real power is. You know, they've got a big army. They can help us. And you'll notice that, you know, Rabshakeh's speech to Hezekiah is, you think you're going to depend on Egypt? They're a bruised reed. If you try to lean on it, it'll pierce your hand. And they're not going to be able to help you. And it comes up again because while Sennacherib is away besieging the city of Lachish, a rumor comes up that the Egyptian army is approaching, so he has to break off and his, you know, forces that were besieging Jerusalem are withdrawn, and Sennacherib has to say, now don't get your hopes up, I'm going to be back, and we're going to finish the job. And they go and, you know, send the Egyptians running back home and do besiege the city of Jerusalem. We'll see how that turns out here in a minute. So I asked this question, what seemingly minor event in the life of Hezekiah turns out to be extremely significant, and that's what Elizabeth mentioned last time, this extending his life by 15 years. And so it's a reminder that, of course, life is a blessing, but it can also be a curse, you know, depending on what you do with it. And I tell you, there's a lesson in that, because the Lord has blessed me with life and a lot of things, and what I've done with so much of it, I'm ashamed to say, is I'm not proud of, and made it more of a curse to others around me and to myself. And how much more so here, this situation has got, because you think of the repercussions of what's going to happen as a result here. So notice in chapter 32, And verse 25, verse 24, in those days Hezekiah became mortally ill. He prayed to Yahweh, and Yahweh spoke to him and gave him a sign. And you notice the writer of Chronicles doesn't tell us what the sign is. Probably everybody knows what the sign is. A lot of little kids in, you know, Sunday school know what the sign is. About the sunlight on the steps going backwards, that kind of thing. And so Hezekiah gave no return for the benefit he received because his heart was proud. And therefore wrath came on him and on Judah and Jerusalem. Which sounds like that was one of the reasons for the Babylonian or the Assyrian reprisals. And however, Hezekiah humbled the pride of his heart, both he and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, so the wrath of Yahweh did not come on them in the days of Hezekiah. And again, in the account in Kings, that even specifies that I will deliver you from the hand of the Assyrians. So that seems to predate the invasion by Sennacherib itself, seems to me. So pride and ingratitude, you think, well, you're fatally sick, you're going to die imminently, and the Lord takes pity on you and extends your life. What a wonderful thing. No, because it led to pride. And that was not good. Now, pride didn't have the final word because he also was able to repent of that and he humbled himself. But been better if the pride and ingratitude hadn't resulted after all. And then the Babylonians show up. And, of course, Hezekiah is showing them all of his stuff, all of his treasures, all of his might and power, which, again, the Bible didn't come out and say this, so, you know, we don't want to make it a matter of faith. But if, in fact, the most plausible reason is because, the Babylonians just aren't up to, well, let's go to, you know, Disneyland and let's visit Hezekiah while we're in the neighborhood. But creating some kind of political alliances. And if the idea is, is Judah a potential or a good ally to have, and Hezekiah is actually flattered by that or entertains the notion or sees that as politically and militarily expedient for the preservation of his kingdom, why then... Well, let me show you what I have to offer. Because God sends Isaiah to chastise Hezekiah for even receiving this Babylonian ambassage. So he says, well, because you've done this, the Babylonians will come, and all this stuff you showed them, they're going to carry off. And so it's not the Assyrians that are going to carry it off. It's not the Assyria you need to be worried about. Ultimately, it's Babylon. And to be able to say that at the time when it didn't look like Babylon was the superpower you needed to worry about is really telling. And then, of course, Manasseh is either born or made co-regent during this time period. And that's not going to bode well for the nation because he's going to lead the nation into such apostasy that God says it is the point of no return. And that's something we're going to wrestle with when we get there theologically because... Later on, during the time of Josiah, well, if you repent, things will be okay. Wait a minute, I thought we're past the point of no return. So you prophets need to make up your mind. Was Manasseh the final straw, or we got a few more straws to go, right? So we'll save that for a little bit later and chew on that. But that is the ultimate cause of the fall of Judah. You see that in 2 Kings chapter 21. And another consequence or repercussion of this is the false hope it creates because Jeremiah, of course, is living through the Babylonian siege of Jerusalem and having to deal with Zedekiah, the last token king of the nation. And it's pretty clear that Zedekiah thinks, maybe if we... make our sacrifices just right and hold our tongue just right and check off all the boxes, God will do to the Babylonians what he once did back in Grandpappy's day to the Assyrians. Of course he could, and had Zedekiah and the nation responded in true faith, God may very well have done that. But no, it's more like, hey, it happened before, it'll happen again. And so Some of them didn't seem that worried as the Babylonians were getting closer. It's happened before. You see, they always get turned away. Jerusalem's never fallen to a foreign nation, so it never will. Well, but it did. And the prophets were telling them that it would. And so what Hezekiah is going to do is make the preparations for the assault of the Assyrians. And we have some of these seal impressions that have survived from the time of Hezekiah. And this is a jar handle that has the king's impression on it. And so the idea is, as you went around accumulating, you know, wheat and wine and olive oil and other things to store up for a siege particularly, well, the king's share is put in these jars that are specially stamped, you know, belonging to the king, and then they're put in these special storehouses. And so you find a proliferation of these during the time of Hezekiah as he's making massive preparations for the Assyrian invasion. So this is a kind of picture of Hezekiah's water tunnel and a depiction of what people envisioned the city would have looked like. So, of course, that's all the artist's imagination. What's important here is the path of the water tunnel. And you'll notice it's not in a straight line. They didn't have lasers to cut through solid rock and so on. They probably followed a natural crevices in the rock. But they're like 100 feet down, 150 feet down in some places, tunneling through solid rock, you know, from both directions, you know, without the kind of GPS or modern technology like we have. And basically, how they mainly did this is somebody was up on top of the ground, whacking the ground with a sledgehammer. And so, you know, you're digging away into there, you hear, listening for the sound, so you know where to go, and kind of adjusting your course as you go. And so there are a few, you know, where they started to go the wrong direction and had to correct it. But that's an amazing feat there. And so you can see the spring is up here on the upper right-hand middle portion, and the stream flows down to the pool. The important thing of all this is it's inside the city walls, so you got a water supply that the besieging enemy does not have access to, and the people trapped inside would have access to. And that'd be just pretty much a perpetual water supply. If you have enough water, you can wait out a siege for a good long time. And so this is the actual water tunnel itself. You can get a picture of how claustrophobic it is. There's actual where they had a false turn, and I just think about all the wasted effort to dig all that rock out for nothing, but that happens. Again, the water is about, I don't know, typically a foot or foot and a half deep in most places. It gets very narrow, and yeah, it's kind of clammy in there too, with the, you can tell the walls are glistening there with water. And here is where there was an inscription written in the time of Hezekiah, in old Hebrew script, and someone went in and chiseled it out and took it away. And so it wound up in the Istanbul Museum, I think. So this is a replica of the pieces put back together. And it gives you an account. They were so proud of how they had dug this. And this is the inscription. It tells you how they did it with the whacking the ground and listening to the sound and tunneling and all that kind of thing. And so it ends with the spring. And then here's another archaeological feature from the time of Hezekiah, the broad wall that, of course, you can see the modern city in portions here. That's the way it is when you're in Jerusalem. Gotta be careful where you dig. Find something underneath your house, and then the government will come and, you know, say, "Well, we'll take 20 years to dig this up, and you can come back and when we're done." So to give you some perspective, there's the broad wall cutting through, and a guy standing there. So it's a nice, very wide wall to help fortify the city. to prepare for the invasion of the Assyrians. So you got 4 years, and you're motivated. You can do a lot of fortifying of the city. And so this is one of a couple of prisms that record the exploits of Sennacherib. And Micah talks about the attack of the Assyrians from the southwest. Isaiah appears to describe them coming from the north as the various cities in those directions fall to the Assyrians as they besiege the city. And of course, Hezekiah, in the end, even though he may have been prideful and had his problems, he trusts the Lord, and he listens to Isaiah's exhortation. And so as a result, God responds, and the people are spared. And even Sennacherib's account of, cooping Hezekiah up like a bird in a cage is something of a roundabout admission. He didn't kill Hezekiah. He didn't take Hezekiah into captivity, execute him, anything, because he couldn't get to him. He didn't take the city of Jerusalem after all. What he does brag about here are the other 46 cities that were fortified in Judah that he conquered and defeated. So we'll see how that turns out here. As a matter of fact, if we... Now, the writer of Chronicles, it gives a much more abbreviated version of this. If you want to read 2 Kings chapters 18 and 19, you get a much more elaborate... blasphemous, speech that Rabshakeh gives at the walls of Jerusalem in Hebrew so the people can hear in their native language, who does this Hezekiah think he is? And if you people think he's going to deliver you out of all of this by trusting in the Lord, you got another thing coming. And, what God is there that's ever been able to deliver anyone out of the hand of the Assyrians? There ain't no such being, and it'll be no different with you people. And then the letter that Sennacherib writes is a blasphemous letter, likewise. So it's really kind of an interesting tale when you couple it with Hezekiah's sickness. Hezekiah got sick, had this miraculous deliverance by God and a miraculous sign that accompanied it. And the Babylonians write him a letter saying, "Oh, you're so wonderful, Hezekiah. And we think you'd be a wonderful person to form an alliance with." And, it's all flattery and good. And the effect of that letter was to at least add to the pride and ingratitude of Hezekiah. Sennacherib writes this very threatening, blasphemous letter, and Hezekiah takes that to the temple, lays it before the Lord, and prays over it, and it's a quite different response. So, letters can have that kind of impact on people. And so, Sennacherib comes along, and let's pick up in verse 10 of chapter 32. On what are you trusting that you're remaining in Jerusalem under siege? Is not Hezekiah misleading you to give yourselves over to die by hunger and by thirst, saying, 'Yahweh our God will deliver us from the hand of the king of Assyria'? Has not the same Hezekiah taken away his high places and his altars and said to Judah and Jerusalem, 'You shall worship before one altar, and on it you shall burn incense'? Do you not know what I and my fathers have done to all the peoples of the lands? Were the gods of the nations of the lands able at all to deliver their land from my hand? Who was there among all the gods of those nations which my fathers utterly destroyed who could deliver his people out of my hand, that your God should be able to deliver you from my hand? Now therefore do not let Hezekiah deceive you or mislead you like this. Do not trust him, for no god of any nation or kingdom was able to deliver his people from my hand or from the hand of my fathers. How much less will your God deliver you from my hand?'" And then there were more words they added to that. And then Sennacherib also wrote these letters to insult Yahweh, God of Israel, to speak against him. I suspect his real purpose was to demoralize the people, but the effect was to blaspheme God, of course. As the gods of the nations of the lands have not delivered their people from my hand, so the God of Hezekiah will not deliver his people from my hand. They called this out with a loud voice in the language of Judah to the people of Jerusalem who were on the wall to frighten and terrify them so they might take the city. They spoke of the God of Jerusalem as of the gods of the peoples of the earth, the work of men's hands. And so this is really a very fascinating part of this taunting of the people. And it's full of irony because, first of all, you notice it tells us a lot about the Assyrian intelligence apparatus. They know what's going on in Judah and that Hezekiah has been making these reforms and tearing down these high places, and they're going to use this information as part of their propaganda here. But everything that's truth is turned into a lie. So it is true that Yahweh our God will save us from the Assyrians, and that's what Hezekiah was saying. But the way the Assyrians present that is, well, that's obviously a lie. That's obviously a deception. That's obviously just a political ploy to, you know, hang you people out to die to save his own neck for a little while longer. And the reforms that Hezekiah was doing, which the chronicler sees as an evidence of faithfulness and trying to comply with God's will, well, the way that gets spun is, sounds like a kind of self-serving power grab. He won't let you worship God anywhere but this one place. Now, who's that benefit, right? He can control you that way. Something like that seems to be the implication. Of course, we've not been defeated by these false gods out here. Well, that's true. But the conclusion that they take from that is we will be undefeated by the one true God there is also, because that God's no different than any other God. In fact, no God has been able to deliver from our hand, how much less your God. We've gone up against some hombres that are way more powerful and their gods were more potent. You haven't got a chance. And so verse 19 is very telling. This is the commentary of the writer. They talk about the God of Jerusalem as if he were one of these other gods, man-made, powerless, false God. And so, again, how does God respond to this? Well, you probably all know the story, how an angel of the Lord destroyed every mighty warrior, commander, and officer in the camp of the king of Assyria. And so he returned in shame to his own land. When he had entered the temple of his God, some of his own children killed him there with the sword. So Yahweh saved Hezekiah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem from the hand of Sennacherib, king of Assyria, from the hand of all others, and guided them on every side. And many were bringing gifts to Yahweh at Jerusalem and choice presents to Hezekiah, king of Judah. So he was exalted in the sight of all nations thereafter. And so it elevated the reputation both of God and of Hezekiah. So the writer of Samuel Kings, it's, 185,000 Assyrian soldiers that die in one night, which is just an astounding number. So, you know, think Jesus saying, I could have called, 12 legions of angels. Well, one angel probably would have done just fine, with that. But again, notice that even though Hezekiah is faithful and he turns to the Lord and the Lord delivers the nation, there's still a high price that's paid here because the massive devastation of the whole nation except for Jerusalem, that's a pretty stiff price. There is still a divine judgment that is part of this, even though ultimately the nation is preserved and Hezekiah and the line of David is delivered from this. So it's, it's pretty astounding. That's another prism or cylinder that has the same information on it. So this is the mound of Lachish. And the lower part here is where the ramp is to the gateway. The big square you see in the middle is the foundation that's left of this massive government building that dominated the town. It's the second largest city in Judah, the most heavily fortified next to Jerusalem. And so you can see why it would be the plum of all of the 46 cities of Judah that Sennacherib reduced. So there's an artist rendering of what that would look like. See the gateway off on the left-hand side with the ramp leading up to it and the big government building there in the middle, the double wall around the city. That's another artist's depiction of that. And here is a modern ramp that's put so you don't walk on the actual remains there. Now, you realize the Assyrians destroyed the city of Lachish. It was rebuilt, and then the Babylonians, when they came back, they destroyed the city of Lachish as well. And you can kind of see that where the lower part that sticks out further to the left-hand side of the screen, that's the lower part of the original gateway during the time of Hezekiah, and then the gateway above that is from the time of the Babylonians. And so this is a bird's eye view looking down on the gateway. The smaller gateway is out toward that field and the inner gateway. And this is how they would build some of the most significant cities. You got to fight your way through the first gateway. And if you can make it through, you're trapped in this little small area where you just get shot, you know, from all sides practically. And then you got to bust through the main gateway. And then there's several chambers there on both sides. And again, that's just going to be a death trap, is the idea. So this is an artist's picture that's kind of superimposed on it. And, you know, when we were there, this was open and you could actually go in and see some of the work that they were doing and so on. And this bottom one on the left-hand side here is interesting because that chamber got converted into a worship center. There was an altar in there. And you also find a toilet in there because one of the best ways to defile a place of worship is turn it into a bathroom. Whether it was actually ever used or not, I think the imagery is enough to, you know, say, oh, we better not worship God here. And so it's just fascinating. That's a, kind of a remnant of somebody's attempt to defile this high place, maybe from the time of Josiah or something like that. And this is what remains of the actual siege ramp that the Assyrians build to get their siege engines up to the wall and to break through. And what they would do is pile it up to get to the top of the wall. And, of course, the people inside, they're tearing down houses and piling up a ramp on the other side so that they just keep getting higher and higher to keep them from breaking through the wall. But you get to a point where you can't build a big enough ramp to stop them, and so they break through. And so Sennacherib was so proud of having taken the city of Lachish that when he went back home, he built a palace called the Palace Without Parallel. Not in English, but, you know, I can't pronounce the Akkadian name. But anyway, and one of the main rooms in this palace is this, you know, over 100 feet of rock carving on the wall depicting the siege of Lachish and the defeat of Judah in that process. So it's really fascinating. And you can, you know, look on YouTube for videos where people do reconstructions of the palace and show you this room and things like that. And here's some pictures of it. It gives you some insight into ancient warfare and what siege engines look like. They actually have these wheeled, armored things, you know, the go up and chip away at the wall and things like that. You can see torches being thrown down from the wall to try to catch some of these things on fire. And part of the picture is to show Sennacherib sitting on his throne as he's kind of overseeing the battlefield and prisoners being brought before him and things like that. So it's kind of interesting. You have, you know, archaeological kind of verification of a lot of these things. Well, we're running out of time to get back into the text here a little bit. A few more things I'd like to say about some lessons we can learn from all of this. But one final thing we could think about is, again, if you're the original reader and you're living in this time of what's happened to the line of David, what's going to become of our pathetic little kingdom We're just the shadow of our former self. So what's the lesson to be learned from the story of Hezekiah, would you say? Okay, so the righteous again, if you, you know, seek the Lord, you humble yourself, you pray, you repent, then that will go well. Now, it doesn't mean you'll be spared invasion or difficult times, because that can happen. But if we respond even to those difficulties in faith and humility, seek the Lord, that'll go well. What else might we learn? Okay. Stay humble, which give God the credit and the praise, right? We certainly the lesson we learn here, they were not delivered by their own military strength, their water supply, the broad wall, their other fortifications and preparations. That's not those things in themselves are inherently wrong. They should have torn down their walls and, you know, taken off their armor and just painted a target on themselves. We're just going to trust the Lord, you know. What else can you think of? Pride goes before a fall. Dan?
Sometimes others suffer consequences.
Oh, that's...
That original slide you had on the beginning was a picture of the Assyrians flaying.
Yeah.
Skinning. Judean alive.
Yeah. Skinning people alive. Mm-hmm. Right? Who may not have had any part in making the choices that led them to where they were, that kind of thing. Well, it's certainly a great crisis that the nation faced, and from a certain point of view, looks like maybe even certain death, certain destruction, certain defeat. And so people living at the time when they're reading this thinking, yeah, it's no good. It's hopeless. You won't talk about a hopeless situation. This is pretty hopeless. But God can still work through this line of David and his faithful people. And so there's hope. As long as we have breath and we're able to humble ourselves and seek the Lord. And so that's what we need to do, right? All right, so we'll leave it there and we'll turn our attention to Manasseh unpleasantly on Sunday after we finish up a few things here from chapter 32.